You're tuning in to the Black Hollywood Live Network, featuring news, interviews, and commentary on all things Black Hollywood. Hollywood redefined. From Los Angeles, California, presented by Maria Menounos and streaming live thanks to Akamai Technologies, this is Black Hollywood Live Portraits. Featuring intimate, in-depth interviews with Black Hollywood stars and influencers. Black Hollywood Live, Hollywood redefined.
You're listening to Black Hollywood Live.
And now, the host for Black Hollywood Live Portraits, Dario Kristen.
Hey everyone, you're watching Black Hollywood Live Portraits. I'm your host, Dario Kristen, and here joining me today is the lovely Courtney Stewart.
What's up, everybody?
DJ hey. Jesse J.
Hey.
And I'm excited about our guest today. He's one of the most recognizable faces in Hollywood. He is an actor, director, writer. Eric LaSalle is with us today.
Welcome.
Congratulations on your new novel that's coming out, Laws of Rap, and you have some directing positions that you're doing this summer, and we're all excited to see and hear more about that. But first, we want to learn a little bit more about you in your younger Connecticut days.
Okay.
We want to go way back.
So now you've had a successful career for over 30 years, and a lifetime in this industry, I think, at this point for a lot of people. And you grew up in Connecticut. At what point did you kind of have that acting bug that did it first come to you?
I think it was when I was a freshman in high school, but it wasn't really about the acting. I wanted to be a writer, and I joined the drama club with the hopes of writing a play that was going to be performed, and you know, it was going to be amazing. And when I showed up, they were like, "Yeah, we need actors." So the first production I did was Raisin and Son. And and then from that point on, I just got hooked. And you know, fortunately, having an idea of what you want to do that early for me was great, because then like that's all I've ever done. That's the only direction I've ever taken. So I joined an acting troupe, improvisational group. Then started getting ready for college. My mentor at the time, his name was Clay Stevenson, who passed away. He said, "Hey, I think you're. I think you should. You might want to go to a school called Juilliard." Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was from Hartford. I never even heard of Juilliard.
Yeah.
You know, but I trusted him and believed that if he said it was good, it was good.
It was good.
So I was like, "All right, cool, let's go." And he said, "You know, I'll help you. I'll get you ready for the audition." And no true concept, and no one in my world knew what Juilliard was, and you know. I come from, you know, very blue collar family, single moms, and, you know, was just hustling, you know, trying to raise a bunch of knuckleheads. So I was like, okay. And then I started doing the research, and it was like, okay, you know, they audition, you know, anywhere from 1 to 2,000 people, and they accept 35. Wow. I was like, whoa, you know. And then all of a sudden, I started seeing more and more about it. And what was really cool, the thing that really got me psyched about Juilliard was they sent me a brochure. As I started filling out things, they sent me a brochure, and on the cover of the drama department was this brother playing Othello. And that just, well, I was just like, wow, you know, just blown away. And this is what they were sending out to everybody, not just the black,
not the black people, not the segregated.
No, yeah, it's like, oh, send them something black, you know. It was, you know. So they sent it out, and it was the actor Keith David.
Keith, he's the
man.
Yeah,
and he was just this striking pose of him, you know. And I was like, wow, like I really want to do this. And so, you know, I went audition, got accepted. Moved to New York, started, you know, I was there for 2 years, got kicked out because they were like, you know, your voice and your diction doesn't, you know, meet our standards. And, you know, sort of a, you know, you got to realize, I mean, my mother was from Georgia, and as, you know, many African Americans, we sort of have that urban southern mix.
Yeah.
Like, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You know, we grew up, you know, it's like cast up nominators, you know what I mean? You know, and I worked really, really hard. I think that the most disappointing thing was when they started telling me, well, we're having problems with your speech and diction. I started taking on extra courses, and I was doing everything I could to do it. So then, by the time you made it to the end of the second year, which is their cutoff point, that's usually when they decide if you go on or you don't. And so it was, to me, it was a surprise, because they kept telling me, wow, you're getting so much better, you're, you know, so dedicated. But I think it was also like a whole point of being 17 and a half, 18 years old. Yeah. And everything you did at that point, as a part of their technique, and I'm not faulting it, because obviously it's an amazing school and it works, but their mission is to tear you down. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any problems with that. I think the one issue that I had was in the tearing down, particularly of a young brother who's trying to define himself as a man, in, you know, like that path is already very interesting. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so all of a sudden now your speech is no good. Your body movement is no good. And then I went to school with, obviously, you know, I went from a 99.99% black high school to a 99.99% white college.
Yeah, that's culture shock.
And it was like, and you know, it's like at that point, you know, like, I mean, I had kids, one of these kids told me, he was like, hey, wow, you're the only other black person I ever met besides my maid.
And wow.
And it just said it with such, and literally, and again, I wasn't mad, but that was the world he came from, and I, just like I came from a certain world. So that was a difficult transition for me, because it was like, okay, your music, I mean, you know, sometimes they would make fun of the music that I listened to, and, you know, I mean, you know, yo, this is, you know, don't talk about Lionel Richie, you know, don't talk about Earth, Wind, and Fire, don't talk about, you know.
Right.
But again, we're all young, so I left there, and fortunately, my mentor stepped in again, and he said, I think you should audition for NYU, but at this point, all the scholarships were gone, and, you know, we didn't have money, so... So I was like, so he got me a meeting with the head of the department, and before, the guy said, look, I'm meeting you as a courtesy, but I got to tell you, all of our scholarship money is gone, because it's June, and so we already dispersed it. So I said, well, I'm here, I might as well audition. So I was in his office, I auditioned just for him, and when I was finished, he said, we'll find a way. And the reason I bring that up is because I think that that's one of the most important lessons I learned. I think it was Roots 2. It was Roots 2. And one of the characters, I believe Dorian Harewood, was accepted into a college.
Yeah.
And he met someone on the train, and he was talking to this gentleman, and he was telling him, yeah, I'm going to be going to his school or whatever. But then, of course, his money fell through. He couldn't, you know, do anything. And somehow he went to the school to tell them that he wouldn't be able to come. Mm. And the head of the school is looking at him and says, your scholarship has been paid for. Mm. And he says, what do you mean? He says, yeah. And the guy that paid for it said, if he didn't show up, don't reach out to him. But the fact that he showed up allowed him to pursue his dream. Oh, wow. And so I like that. Those two lessons for me just said, you know what? No matter how crazy something sounds, no matter what the restrictions are, if you just really believe, you got to show up.
Yeah.
Like, you got to show up. And that's the thing that, you know, like I try to tell my nephew, and he gets it. He's, you know, the younger generation. I'm like, showing up is sometimes half the battle, because there's so many people that, this will never happen. Yeah. So you're not competing with the full field by the time you show up. Sometimes you're competing with just half the field or a quarter of the field, because some people are just like, hey, I don't have the money, I don't have the means, I'm not the right color, I'm not the right gender, I'm not the right whatever.
They block themselves out.
They block, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And so so those were lessons for me. So anyway, so I go to NYU now, I get accepted as an advanced student, so I graduate at the same time that I was supposed to graduate, and then, you know, I started my career. And, you know, did off-Broadway, Broadway, soap operas, a ton of bad movies. you know, man, back then you just happy to have a job.
What's something as far as your writing? You know, you said that at such a young age you knew you wanted to write plays. And, you know, where did that come from? That you knew at such a young age that specifically that's what you wanted to write.
Well, I think it was, you know, I grew up. I used to write poetry and just some, you know, creative stuff. And, you know, my brothers would be like, yo, man, you know, when this girl broke up with me, can you write me something?
That's when lyrics were important, too.
and I was like, boom, boom, boom. And next thing you know, she's, you know, back with him. I was like, wow, I got something here. It didn't benefit me that much, but, you know, so, but I think the play thing was just a part of the fantasy of the thing when people ask me, why do you do so many different things? I don't think of it in terms of doing so many different things. I think of them as being an extension of the same thing. I'm a storyteller, and I've always wanted to be a storyteller. And I think that was the beginning of me wanting to be that part, going from writing poetry or creative stuff. I think that was the stuff that I leaned towards. I mean, and we always excel at the things that we always gravitate towards, the things that we excel at.
Yeah, you know what
I mean?
That's true.
So I was a mediocre ball player. I mean, I didn't see a future there, you know, and that, you know, back in the day when you grow up in, you know, when you grow up in the hood, it's like, that's what everybody's dream.
Yeah.
And I was like, it was cool, but it was like, but I was that cat that was like, it's cold outside. I ain't really feeling like ball. I was like, my brothers are like, yo, what are you doing? I'm like, yeah, I'm a read, man. I'm writing, you know. And they were like, oh, man, you know. So, I just started gravitating towards, and then I started winning, you know, like if there were little competitions and, you know, just little stuff that just kept validating that you have something.
You got it.
You got something. And it's not developed. It's not, but. Again, you have something. I started writing for the school paper. I started. We had a our high school had a radio station, so I became a DJ, and we had handles back then. I'm very bow-legged, and so my nickname was Cowboy. So I was like, yeah, this is Cowboy coming to you.
Even has the voice. It was like, the voice.
WQTQ sending this one out to Monique with the bag. You know? And I was like, that was my rap. You know what I mean? It's like, girl, let me give you a shout out. This is before they even shout outs. You know what I mean?
It's just
like,
you know,
and then I and it was like all the corny variations of what Cowboy is like, yeah, this is Cowboy coming to you with a bang bang, baby. You know?
You better saddle up.
You know, yeah, you better, girl, I'm about to take you for a love ride. You know what I mean? Get on in the saddle. You know what I mean? And I mean, come on, 17 years old with a mic. Yeah,
right.
Come on, man. You know, Sugar Hill Gang had just come out. We were like, then we started rapping and we'd be in the studios battling. But again, it came back to storytelling.
Yeah.
Because when I wrote a rap, it was telling a story. It wasn't just about how many girls, you know, everybody was, oh, I got girls, I got this, I got that. I was like trying to tell a story. You know what I mean? And so I think everything about me was really about storytelling. I think acting is an extension, is storytelling.
Yeah.
I think I got into directing. Directing is storytelling. Producing is the thing that I do more as, I see it for me in some ways as almost, not a necessary evil, but I, you know, you do it to control the project.
Right.
You do it to, you know what I mean? And so it's not anything that I have a natural affinity towards. It's nothing that I'm passionate about, but a good producer is a good storyteller.
Yeah.
So you never want to take that away. But we think of, because, you know, particularly out here, producer is the most overused title.
Very true.
Out here.
Yeah.
In music and in,
that's true.
You know, and in acting. But I think the really good ones are storytellers. So, you know, the producer. Then you write projects, you know, back in the late 80s, I started writing short films. You write to have something to shoot, you know what I mean? So then the writing thing came back because it was dormant for years because I was focusing on being an actor. And, you know, and then that became, you sort of become enamored with that whole thing of, you know, what it means to be an actor. And it was immediate. Everything was so immediate because, you know, you audition, you either get it or you don't get it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so, you know, so I went away from it. And then I came back and started, you know, writing short films.
How long was that period of you kind of letting it go dormant?
Well, I think basically if you think about it, if you say, well, at 14 years old, I had the concept mm-hmm. of being a playwright. And then I would say 28 years old, so between 14 and 28, it was all about being an actor. And
not at all like on the side, still trying to, you know, write something?
Not really, like? Not really. I mean, periodically, I'd write, you know, for, you know, girlfriends, I'd write poetry. That was my rap, man. I was like, you know, so, oh my God, you're so sensitive. You know, you're like, yeah, I got you, girl. You
know? So, I feel like I need a mix CD right now. Yeah.
No. A mixtape.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me get it correct.
Come on, we mixed tape. We have mixed tape. You know, get that little pencil. And you like turning that thing. You got your love, and you know, I got my first apartment, man. I had 4 or 5 of them, and be like, okay,
rotation.
She's Luther Vandross. You know, so, but even then, it's funny because I think when you're an artist, I think you see things very differently because I grew up in such a, it was like such this weird balance because yeah. I was that cat that from the north end of Hartford and, you know, Hartford is a weird place. Mm-hmm. Hartford is the insurance capital of yeah. the world, and it's like, Wikipedia, I think, said it's like the third poorest city in the nation.
Wow.
Which is so insane. Weird. Yeah. Yeah. It's so extreme. And I think that I can be like that. I can be like, you know, over here. And I think even growing up, my brothers always thought I was weird in a way because, I mean, they come home, I'm listening to Rod Stewart and you know, Funkadelic.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, Elton John. I mean, I listen to storytellers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I listen to, you know, like I think, you know, Elton John's Daniel, I think is an amazing story. I think, you know, the Eagles, Hotel California. I mean, I stuff like that. But then at the same time, you know, it's, you know, OJ's is, you know, Earth, Wind, and Fire is Rick James was Rick. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. So there was always this, instead of, you know, back then, and I love where artists are now because, at least musically, that stigma seems to have really sort of disappeared. But back then, it's like, dude, what you listening to that white music for?
Right.
You know what I mean?
And now it's all crossed over.
Now it's all crossed. So. Now it's to me that's amazing because seriously, like back then it was like you had black music, you had white music, yeah. And you know, and that perception. But again, I listened to storytellers. I was affected. A House Is Not a Home is one of the most amazing visual songs.
Yeah.
I mean, you see him climbing the stairs,
literally
turning the key. Yeah. You get a little nervous, you know. You see his hand reaching for the doorknob, and you know you got the key, and you know. But that's what I've always been inspired by, no matter what form it came in. If I started in college, again, this wasn't my background. I don't even know where it came from, but I got hooked on foreign films. I started really going to foreign films, you know, when I was 18, and that just fed me.
What did you get from those films? Like, what inspired you from those?
I got the most important, one of the most important lessons about being an entertainer and being a storyteller, which is, whatever you do, make it about the human experience, and therefore it has no color, no gender, no religion, no race. I've never been that cat that's been trying to do black movies.
Yeah.
Like that, I don't, you know, I want to do movies. If it happens to be populated, and from a, obviously I want to do things from a point of view of African Americans, but I don't want it to be this limited thing.
Yeah.
And so when I would see foreign films, Akira Kurosawa was the great Japanese film director. He had a film called Ran, which is the Japanese version of King Lear.
Hmm.
So that was like a whole double thing. They're like, okay, you got Shakespeare and you got, you know,
Japanese. Right, you got a good mix. Yeah,
people were like, dude, really? You know, and the film was like, when it first came out, it was like 2.5, 2 hours and 45 minutes. And in a span of 2 weeks, I think I saw it like three or four times. And what I got from that was, it makes no difference where it comes from. If you tell it right, people can relate to it.
Yeah.
And so everything I've wanted to do was make people relate to whatever my stories are, regardless to what the character's background is, or you know, any of that stuff. So that was a valuable lesson. And I'm, you know, like right now, I think, you know, like my three favorite films would be Akira Kurosawa's Ran. There's an Italian film called Cinema Paradiso, which is amazing, and The Godfather.
You gotta
keep it real. You know what I mean?
It's just like keep it home. Keep it home.
And so, and these are very, very, very
different.
Very different. Mm-hmm. But as I can understand the American journey, because again, and here's something, you know, The Godfather was never really conceived to be a gangster film. This is what I think. Francis Ford Coppola was so brilliant about it. He was like, I'm not out to, he turned it down. They came to him and said, would you do it? He turned it down. He said, I don't want to do an Italian gangster film. I don't want to, you know, the Italian Americans are always perceived as, you know, in this stereotypical way. I don't want to do it. And he kept, and then he wrapped his brain around it and he said, you know what? I'll do an Italian American family that happens to be gangsters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was more about the relationship, too.
More about the relationships. Yeah. And that's why he had all of his family in it. Mm-hmm. It was about, we learned about, I think there was a movie, I can't remember if it was You've Got Mail, but one of those Tom Hanks movies, they said something like, any lesson that a man ever needs in life, you can find it in The Godfather. Like, you know, it's, you know, like all those great, other, you know, things. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer.
Right.
You're like, got that one. You know? but, you know, I that's, it's a subtle difference, but that subtle difference of your point of view changes. And yes, it's a great gangster film, but I look at it as a family. I mean, that's why all the dynamics, is, you know, when you get to Godfather 2 and Michael having to kill his brother because he betrayed him and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So all of those things for me are about universal storytelling.
Yeah.
And everything always hits me that way, whether it's a commercial, whether it's, you know, a little, you know, whether it's a song, whether it's a book, I don't care who it's about. I just care about the story, and I care about, you know, can people relate to it?
Can people relate to that?
And yeah.
And then you spoke about just being a part of films and not necessarily wanting to be just with black projects, like just universal projects. One of the biggest cult classics is a film you starred in as well, Coming to America, which is just, I mean, I think my friends who are white, black, yellow, whatever it may be, they all love that film and can relate to it. Whenever it comes on, I know many people who will not turn it off.
Right.
And how did it feel for you to be a part of such a classic cult favorite that is just universally loved by everyone?
Well, I think, again, if you look at that film, the structure of the film, it plays on the tried and true tenets of successful films. Fish out of water. It's a romance. Yeah. And it's a royal romance. You know what I mean? And it's like, so I think the concept of a woman meeting a prince, that's universal. That's not black.
Yeah.
The thing that made that film so cool was we weren't used to seeing ourselves depicted in royalty.
That's true.
In the fashion of royalty.
Especially during that time, too.
Especially during that. This is 1987.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, again, but the classic storytelling is, you know, one of the greatest, you know, things is a fish out of water.
Yeah.
So you take that element, I don't care what color it is if you make it right, then, and it was a buddy film,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the classic irresponsible buddy and responsible buddy. I mean, so if you look at all the films, you know, after that and before that, it's like they have the same thing. So, you know, being a part of it again, you know, at that point you are, you're just trying to get a job, you know. That film obviously will always be special, not just for what it became, but the process was amazing because it was one of the few gigs, when I say few, I should say couple, where I go in to meet John Landis And you know, I'm, you know, the trained actor, you know, all my boys, you know, we went at it. When we got auditions, we went at it. You know, we'd stay up 2-3 o'clock in the morning. We were getting our stuff. We went in, we were prepared. And you don't always feel appreciated because, you know, the hours that you spend into that, which is your thing, which is what you the choice you make, but you get in and they give you like 3 minutes and they're like, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And it's true. And just to walk into a room with someone who appreciated the work, and he appreciated the work so much that right then and there, on the spot, no committee, he said, you're hired.
Wow.
In the room.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I'm living in New York at the time, and, I'm just, still struggling and having a great time in the struggle. And then all of a sudden, like, this big-time director just says, right then and there, no, because you've gone through all of the 3-month decisions and the director wants you, but the studio wants this person or all the different reasons not to get a job.
Yeah.
And then here's someone that's just real simple, says, you did a great job, I like you, you're hired. I mean, to the point where I was like, you mean I'm like hired?
Like,
hired.
I can start?
Or am I high? No, I'm not high. Like, you're like, because there's a brain freeze there. Right. You're like, and so, and it's, you're hired. And so that's the note that it started on. And then now your career has elevated. You're in a film with, Eddie was the biggest star at that time.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So you're in this Eddie Murphy film, and and it changes. I remember I was back and forth. So I remember I was out here and I went to a club with one of my boys and we were having this debate about, how phony L.A. was and how, brothers, all they do is front and they
still
always
talking about that today.
Yeah, some things haven't changed.
Right? But they're just, they'll use everything and they're a producer and they're doing this and they're doing that. And I was like, I'm from the East Coast. We don't roll like that, right? So, we go into the club and there was this woman. I'll never forget. This is back in 87. I still remember her name. Her name was Yvette. And she was so fine. Right? And so I'm talking to her, and she's looking past me. I'm trying to have some conversation with her. And, blah, blah, blah. The art, the this, the that.
And you've already shot.
No. I just, but it wasn't out
yet. It wasn't out yet. Okay.
So I'm like, yeah, blah, blah. She's just looking past me and, what baller's here, who's important. Kind of, I guess she didn't want to stand alone, so she kind of stayed there. And I was just getting shot down. Oh. I was just, and I'm like, man. And so literally it was the worst timing. I just turned to her and didn't know it. Just as my buddy was walking by, I go, I'm in a movie with Eddie Murphy. I was like, I'm playing that card, And she, and I was like, she perked up. And I was like, and he walks by like, weren't you the one that just said, you're like, yeah, but she's fine.
Right, I'll make an exception for her.
She is fine, So, but that to me is, for me, it was learning the balance of Hollywood. Because I do think you can come out here, I think you can get lost, I think you can get pulled in a lot of different directions. But I think if you know who you are, you can laugh about it. You can, like you understand, okay, I'm only going so far. I can only do, things to a certain level before. Yeah. But I'm not going to be that cat that's going to be like, selling my soul just to be, And to me, that's what success is. It's not making it. It's making it with your morals and your personal ethics intact.
Yeah,
there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people that have quote unquote made it. And they're miserable.
Yeah.
Because they've prostituted themselves in various ways. So. But that was one of those.
How was the process for you after the movie came out? And you are still young, you're an actor in a huge movie, and now navigating those same waters of
a vet knows
out,
your face.
A vet knows your face, and now it's out there. Like, how did you?
That? I mean, it's an adjustment, and nobody is. I mean, sometimes you use it, and in the sense of, it's great to be able to walk into that crowded restaurant and get a table. Yes, absolutely. Sure. It's great. any artist, the one thing about artists is, and it's such a cool phrase, I think, when you think about it, it's like people say, I love your work. I love your work. I love your work. Mm-hmm. And but people say it so much, I don't know if they're understanding what they're saying.
What that really means, yeah.
But if you really think about it, that's the highest praise you can give an artist. You can actually give to anybody. Yeah. I love your work.
Yeah.
I love your work ethic. I love your talent. I love your commitment. I love the fact that you've struggled. I love your work. I mean, work is such an amazing word, but we throw it out so much. It just sort of becomes this catchphrase.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything, but if you really break it down. So I say that to say, you know, when people started saying that, hey, I loved your work and that thing, it felt good. I mean, you got to take that with all the Soul Glow jokes and all the ribbings and, you know, all that stuff, of course, you know. But I think, you know, I mean, look, it goes with it. And yeah, I mean, you're blessed to be a part of, you know, something. It was, you know, for me, you know, my mother is no longer alive, but, you know, at the time, to take your mother, you know, from Hartford, Connecticut, who struggled, mm-hmm. like I said, to raise a bunch of knuckleheads, and to take her to the Mann's Chinese Theater and, you know, dressed, you know what I mean? And
was she always supportive of you in the process when you, I know you were mentioning like you were kind of like the brother who they were like, why don't you want to play basketball? But was your mother always saying, hey, you know, you can do this, you can accomplish this?
No. And my mother was always supportive as a loving mother. But I think it's really important for particularly African-Americans to talk about these things. I think, unfortunately, like so many generations and so many African Americans, my mother was too scared to dream that big.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she was too scared. My mother, you know, life taught my mother to be pragmatic, mm-hmm. and to go with. And I, you know, in Hartford, Connecticut, you had Pratt and Whitney Aerospace Dynamics, where they, you know, they built planes and got all the government contracts, et cetera, and they were paying really good money, you know, sort of like a Hollywood shuffle, get a job at the post office. You know? Yeah. They were paying really good money. My brother worked for them, and you know, back then, I mean, you could really make a nice living, and so that was the thing. You want to encourage your children to go with that. That's proven. It's safe.
Yeah.
You got to realize, and listen, man, they were, you know, now we've got a ton of references. We've got, you know, young African American girl or boy or Latino or whatever can look up, an Asian even can look up and say, oh, we've got frames of reference. Back then we had Bill Cosby, we had Sidney Poitier, and this is Bill Cosby before the Cosby Show.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. But you know, he was doing I Spy. We had Sidney, we had Harry Belafonte. We only had a handful of examples, and so what would make you believe that some skinny bow-legged kid from Hartford, Connecticut would be, because back then you're taught, they must have some special magic or something.
Yeah.
Like they were born in Hollywood, you know what I mean? It's, they were born at the Hollywood Hospital where only stars are born, you know what I mean? And that's your, because that's your, you know, your limited point of view. And so I think my mother was very afraid of, you know, me getting out there and getting lost. She had preconceptions about what, you know, entertainers were. She said, oh my God, you're going to go to New York, you're going to be a drug addict, you're going to be a prostitute, you know, and then of course, you know, you're going to be gay, and you're like, wow, what?
You're like, I just want to act.
I didn't sign up for all that. I just want to write, I want to act. Like, really? You got me? I'm a gay prostitute strung out on drugs. I was standing on the corner, and I'm like, wow, really? Yeah. I'm dreaming, Mom. I'm just dreaming, you know? And
shout out to you for not holding that stigma in your head.
Right.
Yeah.
You didn't let anybody hold you down.
Dude, I went back to New York. I went to New York. I was scared. I was like, you know, but.
The guy's like, go to Julia. No, I don't want to become a prostitute.
Yeah, I want to be the hoe. I'm not a hoe. I'm not a hoe, you know? But to her credit, she loved the fact that I was the first in my family to really go away to college. I had a brother that, you know, my brother went to a local college and party. He was like, ooh, I'm in college, I get to party. And she saw how serious I was. She made the adjustment in high school. And she was really smart. She didn't get the acting thing. And she had her fears. But the one thing about her, she was smart enough to realize that whatever it is, it's making him a better kid.
Yeah.
It's making him a better young man. He's, you know, I was almost held back my freshman year because, you know, I had my first leather coat. I thought I was cute. Girls started, you know, girls started giving me a little attention.
Right,
I was
right.
like 14. I went through that, you know, I come out of that awkward stage now. And girls like, ooh, you're cute. And I was like, oh, I bumped school, you know. And I was doing some stupid stuff. And then when I hooked up in the drama club halfway through the year, I got on the honor roll. I flipped it, you know, I turned it around. So she would hold it. She would say, okay, listen, if you don't clean your room, you're not going to rehearsal.
Right.
You know, so she learned, and I think it was just sort of like winning her over just in a sense that I have purpose.
Yeah.
I have purpose. I never was into the whole smoking, drinking, hanging out thing. I was like, my big thing was like, Mom, can I go to a drama competition? And, you know, I'll be back at, you know, it's in another state, so I'll be back at 2 a.m, but it's not like me going to a party and I'm coming back with an award.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so again, it wasn't what she understood. It's what she saw her baby doing, which was he's being more positive, more responsible.
Yeah.
And so she supported, you know, that's when she got on board. And then of course, the minute I got, you know, got on a soap opera,
it was,
I might as well have won. You know, I did. And literally, I mean, I just did like, you know, 2 or 3 months on a soap opera. That was one of my first gigs out of college. You know, now she could see it.
Yeah, it's visual.
She could see it. Yeah. And so it, you know, so from that point on, it was like, you know, and then I got to travel and I'd come back, you know, from Europe or something. And I've got, hey, I brought you a gift from Europe. And she's like, you know, oh my God, my baby made it.
So how'd she feel when you got on ER in 1994?
Well, that was obviously one of the highlights of, you know, like, I think the premiere for her, for Coming to America, because, you know, that's, you know, the stars were out.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That night, and people were, and I'll never forget, like, Ronnie Cox, and she was, you know, she loved Ronnie Cox, and he walked up to her and introduced himself. Wow. You know, again, you know, black woman from America's Georgia.
Not expecting. Not seeing it.
World, yeah. And, you know, Paul Abdul, and, you know, like, all these people, like, hi, how are you? You know, and she's like,
whoa,
you know. So, you know, but ER was obviously on a whole, you know, whole
phenomenon. I mean, that was a phenomenon within itself.
Yeah. And she, you know, but like I said, by that time she'd had it for years, but initially it was definitely that fear.
And what was your favorite part about playing Dr. Benton?
You know, I love the fact that there were two things. I love the fact that at that time, you really didn't have a lot of African-Americans in such a prominent role. We were always sort of relegated to the best friend of, you know. As a matter of fact, Michael Beach, who's my best friend for like 32 years, who, by the way, just had his 6th baby. I just came from the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm like, Mike 6E0.
You gotta catch up,
like,
man.
No, catch up. Like, dude, you're winning. I'm holding this newborn, and I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. She's beautiful, but I'm, you know. But I was doing a show in Portland, and he called me up because we never came from that competitive thing. So we shared information about auditions and projects, and you know, our belief is, look, if it's meant for you, nobody can take it from you.
Very true.
If it's not meant for you, nobody can give it to you. You know, mm-hmm. God is already predetermined. So we weren't that petty actor thing of, oh, I'm not gonna. So he called me up. He's like, hey, yo, man, I just read the script. He said, and it's a beast. And I was like, well, that was before we were saying beast. But he was like, you know, it's an amazing role. So I was like, okay, cool. So I read it. He didn't tell me the name of the character. And the cool thing was when Michael Crichton wrote it, and before John Wells, and when John Wells took it, and, you know, and turned, because it was originally written as a movie, and so then when they changed it, they never described Benton as African American, which was great.
Yeah.
So, you know, so, but when I read the script, I was confused because I kept waiting for the smaller black role.
Yeah.
The role was too big to be realistic for us. Like, when we read those scripts, it always was, wow, man, that's an amazing character. He was white.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If it didn't say, it was, you know, and so this didn't say, so I assumed he was white. So I called up Mike and I said, man, that's a great script. I said, but which one is? I said, because it was one character. Man, I love this character. I said, but which one? And he said, Benton. I was like, are you kidding? You know, so, you know, I went in and, you know, did it and got it. And you know, so that was something that was amazing to me. And I like the fact that the year before, Dennis Franz was on NYPD Blue. And he played an unapologetic racist. He was just a racist cop. He was a good cop. And it wasn't, he wasn't ranting and raving, you know, about black people and Latino people. He was just, you know, Latin people. He was just doing his thing. But I thought he played the character with such courage. Because I think actors, we're so concerned about how we look, we the actor. And it's really about the character. You know, we're like, okay, I'll do this, but I'm only going to do it so far.
Yeah.
Because this is going to make me look bad. But when you see the actors, and it's just a few, when actors really commit and go, hey, whatever, judge me however you want to judge me, I'm going to be true to this character. And so that show came on a year before ER, and I was a huge NYPD Blue fan, so I would watch it, and I was like, wow. I said, if I ever got a chance to do that, I hope I would have the courage to just do it, whether you like the character or not, just be true to. And then Ben came along, and I was like, wow, sometimes you like him, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you, yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, and so I ran into Dennis Franz at an award show, and I just told him, I said, thank you, because I don't know if I'm doing it as well as you, but you inspired me to just, I just want to do him. I just want to be, so I like the fact that he was surly, but he was smart, but he cared. And that was the thing that people, you know, you got to, when you do characters, they got to have something that you can relate to, but don't apologize. And I just made a decision. I said, I'm not going to apologize for who this man is. Yeah. It's okay for you not to like, you don't have to always like him, but you'll always understand that in his mind, he's always trying to do the right thing. That's all you really need to know. And so I'm going to push Carter. People like, oh my God, you're so mean to Carter. And, you know, and it's like, you know, and Noah and I were like the closest to one, and out of the whole cast, we were the closest to, and still are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's so funny because, I'm like, you know, people are like, you're so mean to Carter, you know, and you're like, fine. You know, but at the end, you also understood how much he loved Carter.
Yeah.
How much
you could see it. Yeah. You always could see
that. Yeah.
And you've gone on to do some amazing other projects since then, and added directing to your repertoire.
Resume.
How is the difference for you with directing coming from the acting side of things? Like, do you feel like it was a benefit to help you in directing, or
yes or no? Okay. Yeah, I think I assumed when I started directing that the industry would be like, wow, this, you know, he does it both. I think it hurt me in a way because people don't always know what to do with when you're multi-talented because they want to keep you in a box. So if you do A, you can't possibly do B well. If you do A well, you can't do B because they can't conceive it, so you can't do it. So I think a lot of people, and I made a conscious choice not to direct ER. While I was on it, because I never wanted people to say, oh, he got that job because he's one of the lead actors.
Yeah.
So I started, the first film I did was for HBO. It was with Don Cheadle and James Earl Jones. It was called Rebound.
Rebound, yeah.
And that, you know, I was going away from, you know, ER, and I directed the pilot for Soul Food on Showtime, and so I was doing all these other things. I didn't direct ER until I left, and then I came back. And then the final season, I directed it. So in that way, it was always a struggle. And people, you know, people having this preconception, you know, oh, he's an actor that directs, you know. And it took me years for people to start, I think, really seeing the directing individually and saying, you're a good director. The way that it helps is I'm known as an actor's director because I know how to communicate with actors. I know I have a have a huge respect for actors, so I don't give them the regular BS.
Yeah.
If somebody, I was directing a show a couple of months ago, this NBC show called Crisis, and they wanted this actress. They wanted this actress doing something. They wanted her basically speaking out loud, to having a conversation with herself out loud. And so she looks at me and she goes, people don't do this. People don't have full-on conversations with themselves out loud. They'll say one or two things, but they don't, oh, man, what am I going to do? Well, maybe I'll, unless you got some issues. Mm-hmm. And she clearly didn't have those kind of issues. So she said, listen, at the end of the day, this is what they want. I'm not going to BS you. I'm not going to, because a lot of directors will be like, well, you know, actually, you know, sometimes you can, you know, and we sit there and we go, why are you lying? And so my whole thing was like, yeah, look, it don't make sense to me, but we got to do it, and you got to make yourself look good doing it.
Yeah.
And she said, thank you. She said, thank you. I'm like, for not BSing me, you know what I mean? And I said, I agree with you. I don't think people talk like this, but for whatever reason, this is what the network wants, this is what the producers want, and it is our job now, whether we agree with it or not, it's our job to do the best that we can with it. Yeah. And so, but more importantly, it's like being able to pull performances out of actors and having actors trust me. And that's a huge thing. And so I directed a show that's actually getting ready to come on. There's a new medical show called Night Shift for NBC. And so I went in and directed that, and the actors really responded to me. The producers asked me to come back, help reshoot the pilot, reshoot other episodes. So it was, you know, really cool because they really trusted me.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, the network called me in and said, hey, listen, we love what you did on that show. That's how, you know, I got on Crisis. So I'm developing that reputation as being, he can fix it through, like, he's really strong with performances. He's strong with his camera moves, but in storytelling. But the performance part, because sometimes you have these young actors, it's different. It's different from the type of training. First of all, and this might get me in a little trouble, but I'm going to say it. I, at the time, I'll be diplomatic. At the time when I was coming up, the training was much stronger for the East Coast actors.
I've heard that before, too.
In the West Coast. Okay. I don't want some LA actor. Right. I was listening to the show.
Don't go to his Twitter.
Don't hit me. Yeah.
We all know. Okay. You know, it's pretty much the same.
Okay. So as a result of that, you know, I think when you have that strong training, I think now it's, you know, actors are getting on shows and they don't know what they're doing. And directors, many directors are what we call traffic cops. Okay, can you move here? They block, but they can't feed you. If you get into trouble, they can't get you to say, well, I can't make sense of this scene. Yeah. I'm having problems. They're like, well, no, you're great. Just keep doing it. And they're like, you haven't told me anything.
Yeah.
So I'll get in and say, okay, listen, let's talk about this. Let's get, and the next thing you know, they go, wow, okay, thank you. So that's a big plus, and that's the kind of director that I want to be known as. And so now it feels good. But, you know, it took me several years to be known as, you know, wow, he's a good director. Yeah, and then the flip side of that is, oh, he's not acting anymore.
Right. Unfortunately, in this world, you have to do one or the other in people's perceptions.
Yeah.
Now, where did it transition from you becoming actor director to writing your novels?
Author.
Yeah, author. Right on, for Laws of Depravity, and now you recently have the new Laws of Rap
coming out next month.
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes my failures are more interesting than my successes, and I think that's true with a lot of people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I look at my failures and I'm like, wow, you know, that was pretty interesting how you bounce back from it and where it took you. And I had attempted to write a novel about 4 years ago, and it was pretty bad. it was kind of sneaky, you know.
So was there more pressure this time to put up the second one to write this?
No, because I found the first one I did was, you know, I found my genre the second time around. Mm. And I found that some of my deficiencies and some of my shortcomings, I found a way of making them work for me. And the main one is this. I may have a sort of undiagnosed case of ADD because my attention span is about this short, right?
I think we all do in this
room,
too.
So I write that way, which means everything I write is a page turner because I'm in and out. It's all pace. That pace fits very well with the thriller genre. Because you want a page, you want that. Oh my God, what's going to happen? What's going to happen?
Yeah.
And so I don't do these long drawn out. And sometimes it kills me because people be like, "Oh, did you read such and such a book? It's really good." I mean, you know, when you make it past the first 100 pages, then it starts flowing. I'm going, make it past the first 100 pages.
Make it past the first tip of an
hey, you know,
you're
so,
like, wait, oh,
yeah.
Easy.
So, I was reading something. And I didn't know this, and a lot of people don't know this, but this was the inspiration for the first book. And this is when I was like, I got to do this. I learned that all of Jesus' disciples were brutally murdered. And they were beheaded, speared, crucified, dragged through the streets, torn limb from limb, stoned to death, every last one of them. And it wasn't just 12. He had what was called the greater and lesser apostles. So he had about close to 30 people that rode with him, right? But we know about the 12. All of them, except for John. John was put into a vat of boiling oil and survived. Hmm. And then he was banished to the Greek island of Patmos, where he wrote the book of Revelations. He's the only one, the only disciple to die a natural death after surviving being, you know, put into a vat of boiling oil. And I was like, wow, like I go to church, but I never knew this. And it's not in the Bible, but it's biblical historians. If you Google the death of Jesus' disciples, you'll see this. And so I was like, you know what? It would be really, really interesting to come up with a modern-day serial killer who's killing fallen priests in the same way that the apostles were killed. And because one of the key things about thrillers is you got to have an original killer. And you got to have original killings. Because so-and-so got shot. Okay. So-and-so got stabbed, you know. But I was like, wow, what a, you know, cool way. So I was like, I got to come up. And that was the thing that really got me. So I came up with the story. I came up with the crimes before I even came up with the protagonists. And then I created these two characters that I thought were really cool. One is Italian and Irish American. And the other one is African American. And these are the, you know, they solve the top crimes, top homicides, and serial killers. And they are like brothers, and very different cultures. And so I put them together, and then I introduced a female FBI agent that works with them. And so it became like this three-person team. And the thing about my writing is, another key thing for writing great thrillers and great stories is that a lot of times people make the mistake of they make the bad guy much more interesting than the good guys. Because the good guys, they have more rules they have to live by. But I think it's really, really interesting where your protagonist has demons that they're battling, even in the face of trying to do something good.
Yeah.
But they have, and if you look at it, the anti-hero is really being, I think, much more appreciated. And this is what foreign films taught me. Foreign films taught me that because, back in the early 90s, if you think about it, American filmmaking what they would do is the good guy would finally catch the bad guy who killed his partner or killed his wife or whatever, and he'd have his gun on the bad guy. The bad guy is on his back looking up, and he's shaking, and he's about to shoot, and someone would come and say, "He's not worth it.
Yeah.
Think about so-and-so, and think about..." And then he would calm down, and then he'd take his gun, and he would turn to walk away, and the bad guy would then reach for a gun or a knife in his sock or his shoe, and then he would turn around. He was justified. He was justified in killing him.
Yeah.
Now, I got hip to John Woo back in the early 90s. John Woo was like, "Yo, you killed my brother, you killed my partner, bam." and I'm the protagonist.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow. And I always thought, so then think about what happened in the 90s. We got hooked on, and then in 2000, we got hooked on Tony Soprano. We got hooked on. We started rooting for. You look at Breaking Bad. You look at these characters that now they have demons, and so my protagonists, they have things that they're working on. They are struggling with, and they're going as they're going after some of the most heinous, you know, people that have committed these. These amazing crimes, but they're dealing. So that is how I got in. Again, it's storytelling, but from a business point of view, and this is something I've been preaching for years to anybody who will listen. I just think right now it's an amazing time because you have so many different networks and channels. But the one thing that is needed, that will always be needed, is content.
Yeah,
and we as minorities. We don't own content.
That's true.
We don't. And the thing that I've been preaching is always has been black ownership. And so, from a creative point of view, I'm attracted to this expansion of the things that I do because of creative expression. But from a business point of view, I'm saying, hey, listen, I was a teammate on one of the biggest teams. Ever in television,
yeah,
I was a team, you know.
Yeah.
But and I became rich as a result of it. Let's talk about wealthy.
Yes.
Let's talk about ownership. Where the thing I love in this industry sometimes is like, you find a smart producer, he will sell that same product four different times, four different ways, and you're like, wow, he's going to repackage it, or she's going to repackage it, and boom, she's getting money. She get money for life, and so. We don't own enough.
That's true.
And so for me, creating this, it was never about, you know, when people started coming out and saying, oh my God, I love this book. And some people started volunteering and saying, how do we get the first book out? How do we do this? And I kept telling them, I said, one of the first things you guys have to understand, this is not about selling a book. I'm not trying to sell a book. I'm trying to sell a franchise. Mm. And so I've created a series, and I'm going to do 6 books. And I'm going to put out a book about every 6 months for the next 2 years.
Okay.
That's the personal goal that I have.
And where can fans find Law's Rap? We unfortunately have to wrap up ourselves, but I want to make sure the fans know where they can get the book when it comes out.
Laws of Wrath, actually, what we're really encouraging people to do is to pre-order right now. It's going to be available everywhere. It comes out in June, but we're asking pre-orders because... The book is tracking so well with the pre-orders that we actually have a very solid chance of becoming a bestseller. So if you go to Amazon, Kindle, Nook, any of the places that you get your normal reading, if Barnes & Noble, if you go there and pre-order, because we are in the rankings, we're headed towards bestseller if we can keep up.
Yes.
Wow. So we're really
congratulations.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And then if they want to find you on social media,
I'm Twitter. I have a Facebook page, Laws of Depravity Facebook page.
Okay.
And I actually talk to, you know, I have great conversations with people on Facebook, but definitely through Twitter. But like I said, you know, we're really pushing at this point, you know, through all of the social media. For people to go and I just learned about the power of pre-ordering. It's almost like Nielsen's.
Yeah.
It's like one pre-order represents more than one.
Yeah.
And so when we looked at the rankings and we were like, oh my God, this is where we are and this is where we're headed. So we're like, look, please go pre-order the book. It comes out in June. I'm going to be doing book clubs, but anywhere you get it, Amazon, like I said, Barnes and anywhere if you just go online. And if you also go to my website, I am Eric LaSalle. .com. Not only that, but you can get the first free chapters free.
Because
I'm like, look, I'll give it to you. It's like the old hustler, you know. Like I'll give the first one's on me, and then once I get you hooked, and you're like, oh my god, I gotta get it. So I believe in the work, and so we're like, look, go ahead, you can have it for free. So I am EricLaSalle.com, EricLaSalle23 on Twitter, and Laws of Depravity Facebook page.
Everyone, go pre-order your book. Yes. I know I'm going to do mine. I might do it as soon as I leave here.
Right.
Courtney, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Stuart Starlet.
Jesse?
DJ Jesse J.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
You
enlightened
us.
You gave us great information. And I can't wait to read the books.
Hey,
so.
Thanks, man. It was a great show. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Be sure to tune in to Black Hollywood Live Portraits next week.
From producers Maria Menounos, Dario Kristen, Tiana Hobson, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire BHL crew, we would like to thank you for supporting Black Hollywood Live, the first online broadcast network dedicated to African-American entertainment. For questions and comments, contact us at info@blackhollywoodlive.com. Like us on Facebook, tweet us, or Instagram us at BHL Online. And I'm your BHL announcer, Scipio. Instagram me at Planet Scipio. Thank you for tuning in. The views expressed here are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of BHL or its owners or principals.
Thanks for watching Black Hollywood Live on YouTube. For more in-depth interviews and news, subscribe to our channel here and be sure to share your opinion in the comment section below here. See you soon, everyone. Bye.